All right. So thanks everybody for coming today. Our second talk of the week is Alexandra Utyralova from MIT, who will tell us about Harishchandra pi modules and complex rank. So take it away.
Okay, thank you so much for having me here. It's a great honor for me. So I'll be talking about Harishchandra pi modules in complex rank. And when I say that I do something in complex rank, I mean that I consider it in the context of doing tensor categories. So, okay, let me say a few words about the structure of the talk. So I'm going to cover some of my results from the preprints you can find on archive. And so I want to start with giving an overview of the Deligne categories in case you haven't seen them. But yeah, I apologize to everyone who knows all of this. I really want to give as much detail as possible in 1 hour. So yeah, so I'll give an overview. And I'm also going to talk about the so-called ultra product construction for the Deligne categories. And this will be a mighty tool that we'll use later to prove some results. Yeah, and then the second half of the talk, it will concentrate it with Harishchandra pi modules, and we'll give an overview of the classical case as well, of the classical Harishchandra pi modules, and I'll talk about the theorem about the classification of central characters of Harishchandra pi modules in the context of Deligne categories. And lastly, I'll quickly talk about Harishchandra pi modules of finite K type and what they are. Okay, so let me start. So intuitively speaking, the categories RepGLT are defined as an interpolation of the categories of representations of group GLN to complex value of the parameter N. And now more rigorously, RepGLT is defined as a Karubi envelope of the symmetric rigid monoidal category that is generated by a single object V of dimension T. And we also require that endomorphisms of the K tensor power of V are precisely the group algebra of SK, a symmetric group SK, where SK acts here by permuting the tensor factors. And we also require that there are no homes between the K tensor power of V and L tensor power of V unless K is equal to L. And let me break down this definition a little bit. So when I say we take the Karubi envelope, I mean that we formally adjoin images of all idempotents and of finite direct sums. V has dimension T. This means that if we take this sort of composition of co-evaluation and evaluation with a flip in the middle, so then this is going to be a morphism from the unit object to itself, and this is some constant, and V requires that it's multiplication by a complex number T. So since this is categories that is generated by this single object V, every indecomposable object is going to be a direct summand in this generating object, which I denote RS. It's just the notation for R-fold tensor product of V with itself and the tensor is S tensor power of V dual. Okay, so this is just a notation I want to fix. Now, so we want to understand, I first want to quickly comment on the fact that I'm only talking about RepGLT. So just, I'm going to do this for simplicity, just not to introduce too much notation. So, but everything can be generalized also to not type AK, to the categories RepOT and RepSPTT. And we done this generalization jointly with Serena Hu. And so now we want to understand a bit more about this category of GLT. And we want to look at this generating objects, RS and R prime S prime, and what are the homes between them? Well, we use duality and see that this is the same as homes from R plus S prime tensor power V and R prime plus S is tensor power of V. So, and we've seen that this is zero unless the two sums are equal. But we want to understand, so this is a vector space isomorphism, and we want to understand the algebra structure as well. So we want to look at the endomorphisms of our generating object RF. And the algebra that we get is going to be the so-called Wald-Brauer algebra, BRST. And this algebra has a nice description in terms of some diagrams. Unfortunately, I'm quite short on time to give like the full definition of this, but we want to use some results about this algebra. First of all, it's quite obvious that we have an injective map from the group algebra of the product of two symmetric groups, SR and SS, into our BRST. And this is because, well, endomorphisms of this RS contain endomorphisms of R of V, R stands R tensor power of V, and S is tensor power of V dual. So we can just permute the first R tensor factors or and permute the second S tensor factors. And this gives us an embedding. And it turns out that this math has a splitting, which I denote by pi. And roughly speaking, we want to consider an ideal that is generated by compositions of evaluation and coevaluation. And if you generate an ideal by this, it turns out you will have a surjective map onto the group algebra of the product of two symmetric groups. Okay, now if we want to classify decomposable objects in our category, we need to classify primitive idempotents in this BRST. And this was done by Combs and Wilson. And so the result is the following. So recall that if we want to classify primitive idempotents in just the group algebra of SK, then they're labeled by partitions of size K. And so let me, for any partition nu, denote by Z nu the corresponding primitive idempotent in C of SK. Then to any bipartition, that means just a pair of partitions where lambda mu, where lambda is a partition of R and mu is a partition of S, we can assign a unique primitive idempotent, which I denote E lambda mu, in BRST, such that pi of this E lambda mu is the product of the Z lambda and Z mu. And recall, we also have this map I, the embedding. So we can consider this tensor product of Z lambda and Z mu as a literal element in our algebra. But it will still be an idempotent, but it will no longer be a primitive idempotent. So we can decompose it as a sum of primitive idempotents, and E lambda mu is the only primitive summand that is mapped to something non-zero. Well, and by necessity, it is mapped to the same thing. Yeah, and this gives us the full classification of primitive idempotents in BRST. And as a corollary of this, we get that decomposable objects in RepGLT are labeled by bipartitions lambda mu, and I denote this corresponding decomposable object by V lambda mu. And well, if lambda is a partition of R, mu is a partition of S, then V lambda mu is a direct summand in this object RS. And also this property here, it gives us another description of this, another way of thinking about this V lambda mu. Basically, so V lambda mu is going to be also summoned in the Schur functor as lambda applied to V tensor, Schur functor as mu applied to, applied to V dual. Yeah, and it will in some sense be some maximal submodule, indecomposable submodule in this, but you can, yeah, rigorously say what it means, but yeah, just to give you an intuition of what these indecomposable objects are. Okay, and now the dealing categories, they also enjoy a nice universal property. So if D is a symmetric tensor category, then this set of isomorphism classes of symmetric tensor functors from RepGLT to D is on bijection with the set of isomorphism classes of objects in D of dimension T. And the bijection is given via sending F to F of V. And now, a natural question to ask is, so what happens when T is an integer, is a positive integer? How does RepGLT compare to the category of representations of GLN? And so are they equal? Well, they are not equal, but this universal property gives us a functor, symmetric tensor functor from RepGLT to RepGLNC when T is equal to N. To the category of representations of GLN over C. And this functor sends our generating object V to Vn, the tautological n-dimensional representation of GLN. And this functor turns out to be essentially surjective and full, but it's easy to see that it's not faithful, right? Because so we had this condition that endomorphisms of the case tensor power of E were precisely given by the group algebra of SK. Now, if we plug in into this equation n-dimensional vector space, and when K is greater than n, it's easy to see that the skew symmetrizer in here acts by zero. So yeah, so our functor is not faithful. But we can still ask where it sends our indecomposable objects. And now, so if lambda mu is a bipartition, length of lambda is L, length of mu is M, and N is greater or equal than L plus M, we can define the following weight for GLN. So we first put the parts of lambda in the decreasing order, then some bunch of zeros, and then minus the reversed partition mu. So it seems to see that it's going to be an integral dominant weight for GLN. And it turns out that when T is equal to N and it's greater than L plus M, our functor F sends the indecomposable object V lambda mu to the simple representation of GLN with this highest weight. And when N is less than L plus M, then it sends the corresponding decomposable object to zero. And and lastly, I wanted to note that a priori, our category was defined as a Kerubi envelope of something. And so a priori it was Kerubian, but not abelian. And but it turns out that it is going to be abelian and more of a semi-simple, if and only if T is not an integer. Okay, and so this is all about this quick overview. And now I want to go to define the outer product and state the outer product construction for the categories RepGLT. So if you have any questions about this part, maybe it's a good time to ask them.
So if T is a negative integer, is it still abelian?
Oh, no, it's not going to be abelian, and you will have, so here I just...
It's abelian if and only if T is in Z. So I'm wondering what happens.
Yeah, so if T is not an integer, it's still not abelian. A negative integer.
If it is an integer, but a negative integer.
I just said something wrong. Yeah, if T is a negative integer, it will not be abelian. And this is because, in some sense, it sits over. So you will get a functor from RepGLT to the category of representation of this supergroup RepGLM minus M M minus T M, something like this. Yeah, and you will get a functor to the category of representations of the supergroup. So it's a more general construction here. So you can you get many functors. So for each M, there is a functor, right? You just want the difference of two numbers to be, plus T, and T is a negative integer. Yeah, that's what I wanted to.
So if M goes to infinity, is that functor an equivalence?
Oh, so that's a nice question. So if M goes to infinity, what you'll get actually is an abelian envelope. So this is a construction for an abelian envelope. So for any integer T, you can construct some universal category into which your RepGLT embeds. And it is an abelian category, and it's, an abelian envelope. So it has a universal property of an abelian envelope. And this is constructed precisely in the way you're saying. So you take M going to infinity, and you take sort of the limit of this thing. So that's a nice question, yeah. But you will get something larger, so the answer is yeah. You will get something larger and something abelian, of course, but anything else? Okay, so now I want to talk about the ultra product construction. And I'll start by defining what an ultra filter is. So an ultra filter in an NMT set S is a set of subsets of S that satisfy the following properties. So if for any U1 and U2 in F, we ask that the intersection is in F. If for any U, exactly one of U and the complement of U is in F. And if U1 is in U2 and U1 is an F, then we also ask that U2 is an F. And another way of thinking about this is that ultra filters are basically the same as F2 valued characters of the ring of F2 valued functions on S. So F2 valued functions on S are basically the same as subsets of S. And then you can, to any character, you can assign the set of subsets on which it takes value 1. So is there like two values, either 1 or 0. So, and then you can check that the property of being the character for this ring is the same as satisfying these three relations here. And so a basic example of an ultra filter is the following. So you fix an element S in S, then the principal ultra filter Fs consists of all subsets of S that contain a fixed point S. And on the level of F2 valued characters, it's the same as evaluation of your function at the point S. And now if S is a finite set, then all characters are evaluations and all ultra filters are principal. And but for a non-finite, for an infinite set, it can be shown that there exists a non-principal ultra filter. And what matters for us is that it exists for the set of natural numbers. And so it can be shown that there exists a non-principal ultra filter on N. And however, the proof for this is not constructive. It uses Chern's lemma. So we cannot actually produce this ultra filter and say what it is and what values it takes. Yeah, just something that exists. It can be also shown that this ultra filter must contain all cofinite sets. Now, let us fix some non-principal ultra filter F on N. Then for a collection of non-empty sets Xn, for N running in for the set of natural numbers, we can define their ultra product as a quotient of the product by an equivalence relation. And so we say that two strings of number of elements are equivalent, and two sequences of elements are equivalent if they are equal for almost all k. And that is to say that they're equal for all k in some U in F. And you can also modify this definition a little bit to allow some of the accents to be empty. But I just don't want to give all the details. And now, there is a very nice theorem by Voss that roughly states that any first order language statement that is true for almost all accents is also true for their ultra product. And so I want to illustrate this theorem with a few examples, which only be important for us. So the main example is the following. So if all accents had some algebraic structure, for example, they were groups, algebras, or fields, then the ultra product will also have this algebraic structure, and it will be inherited from this structure on the product of this set. And now if accents are vector spaces over the corresponding fields Fn, then their ultra product is going to be a vector space over the ultra product of this field. Now, so there is also something that is not an example of a first order logic statement. So if Vn's were finite dimensional vector spaces, then the ultra product is no longer necessary. It's not necessary finite dimensional anymore. And but you can ask that the dimensions of Vn have like the universal bound for all n, then the ultra product is going to be finite dimensional because the property of being a basis is a first order logic statement. Sorry, yeah. And so this is a statement that survives taking the ultra product. However, finite dimensionality is not a statement that will survive this. And now, another example important for us is the following. So let us take Fn to be the algebraic closure of Q. Then the ultra product of Fn by Voss's theorem is going to be an algebraically closed field of characteristic zero. And it can be easily checked that the cardinality of this field is continuum. And therefore, by Steinitz's theorem, it is non-canonically isomorphic to the field of complex numbers. Okay, so yeah, so these are important examples. Now, if we have a collection of small categories, n, for n in n, we can define the ultra product as follows. So C is an ultra product of the category Cn. Objects of C will be just the ultra product of objects of Cn. And for any pair of objects, x and y, we can define the home for, between x and y as the ultra product of the corresponding set. And it can be easily seen that by Voss's theorem, so if a category was linear, well, Cn's were linear over some fields, Fn, then our category C will be linear over the ultra product of these fields. Now, the theorem by Abdulin says the following. So if T is a transcendental complex number, then the category RepGLT is isomorphic to, well, to the Karubi envelope, the same as before, of the symmetric rigid monoidal subcategory. So it is going to be a subcategory in the ultra product of the categories of representations of GLN over Q bar. And this subcategory is generated by the single object V, that is the ultra product of Vn's, where Vn is a tautological n-dimensional representation. And yeah, so this is the statement. So, and we need to pick the right linear structure here. And it's going to be a C linear category because the ultra product of Q bars is isomorphic to C. But we need to pick an isomorphism in the way that this object V has dimension T. And note that this Vn's all have dimension n. So we need to pick an isomorphism that sends the sequence of numbers 1, 2, 3 and so on to our fixed complex number T. And it's easy to see that you can only obtain transcendental numbers in this way, because there's no polynomial that is zero in all non-zero natural numbers. And so there is a way to do similar thing for an algebraic T. But for this, you need to be able to solve equations. So you need to give so you need polynomials to be zeros on all positive integers. And for this purpose, you need to consider, instead of u bar, you need to consider fpn bar. Yeah, and so this result is due to Nate Harmon. So he constructed this ultra product, gives this ultra product construction for algebraic values of T. But I will, for simplicity, assume that T is transcendental. We will only work in characteristic zero. Okay, so this is ultra product construction. So do you have any question about this part?
So how much, I mean, this is for a given choice of F, right?
Yeah, yes. So in a sense, this says that it doesn't really depend on F, but in the end, no matter which F you choose, you will still obtain this category of GLT if you take this subcategory. But otherwise, it depends on the choice of the ultra filter. But in some sense, it doesn't matter to us because. So it's still very not constructive. So the proofs are still going to be very non-constructive. So the only thing that matters for us is maybe that this ultra filter contains all cofinite sets. So this is just the main way of proving stuff. So it doesn't matter which non-principal ultra filter it is. It's just something we can use about it, is that it contains all cofinite sets. But I mean, it depends a lot on the ultra filter, but we don't really know in which way, so it's hard to compare to different ultra filters, yeah. If it makes any sense. Any other questions or anything else about this particular question? Maybe I didn't answer this properly.
We can always discuss ultra filters more after the talk. So I think you should continue.
But in a sense, the theorem is true for whichever ultra filter you choose. It's definitely true. Okay, and so now let me move on to some representation theory in complex rank. So let me define the Lie algebra GLT. As an object, it's going to be just the tensor product of V with residual. And now we have this ultra product construction, and it's easy to see that this is the ultra product of GLNs. And each GLN acts on all objects in its corresponding category. And so there are other ways to prove this, but the ultra product construction, it sometimes makes some of the statements obvious. So you can easily see now that GLT acts on every object in IND of rep GLT and IND completion of rep GLT. And I will refer to this action as the natural action of GLT. You can also define the universal algebra of GLT. similarly to the way it's done in the classical case. So we take the quotient of the tensor algebra GLT by the standard commutator relations. And so it has a filtration, Poincaré-Virgo fit filtration that is inherited, so in the FKU, it is inherited from the filtration on the tensor algebra on GLT. And now FKFU is the outer product of FK FU of GLN. And here FK is just the regular PBW filtration of the universal enveloping algebra. And I need this filtration because I just want to stress this because it will be important in the future as well. So I need filtrations to use this outer product construction because it is defined only for rep GLT, not for incompletion. So only this finite dimensional objects are going to be ultra product, and the end objects are going to be limits of this ultra product. And now, if Z is the center of U, so we can realize it as homes from the unit objects to U. Therefore, it's just a regular algebra. U is an algebra in the category of GLT, but Z is going to be just an algebra in the category of vector spaces. And so it has this inherited filtration, Fk of Z, and Fkz is the outer product of Kz of U of GLN. And we know what the center of U of GLN is. So it's a polynomial algebra with n generators, each in degrees 1 through n. And therefore, using this, it's easy to show that our center is going to be a polynomial algebra in infinitely many generators, Zi, labeled by positive integers, such that, the degree of Zk is equal to k.
I'm sorry. So this conclusion, do we actually need this ultra filter argument, can this be shown?
No. It can be shown without the ultra filter. Definitely can be shown. It's just now that we have the ultra filter, some of the statements can be seen from this. But of course, no. We don't really need this to prove stuff. Actually, it's just sometimes, just an easy explanation now, an easy computation. Okay, but having the outer product construction, we can now specify a particular choice of generators in Z. And we will do this as follows. So Zi is going to be the outer product of the Zins. Zin is going to be a central element in U of GLN of degree N, of degree I. And we just want to make a particular choice of generators for the center. And for the center of U of GLN, we have this Harishchandra isomorphism. So therefore, we need to specify some function invariant, some function on the set of weights that is invariant under the action of the Weyl group. And for U of GLN, for GLN, the Weyl group is just a symmetric group. Therefore, we need to specify some symmetric polynomial. And this is going to be just my choice of generators here, just for simplicity, just to fix a choice. And my choice will be the power sums polynomial. Therefore, so I want Zn to act on the Verma module M chi with the highest weight chi minus rho via the ith power sum of the coordinates of chi. Now, let me give also the definition. So if you have a central character, theta, from Z to C, so we can define its exponential generating function in a regular way. So theta of U is going to be a sum of 1 over I factorial theta of Zi Ui. And since our central character is determined by its values on the generator Zi, it's also determined by this whole exponential generating function. So this is just the compact way of storing information about the central character. Okay, so now I want to define Harishchandra by module finally. And I want to do this in the most general setting that I can allow. But I will do this simultaneously for rep GLT and for representations of some reductive group G. So let C be either rep GLT or the category of representations of reductive group G over C. And let G small be the corresponding Lie algebra object. So for rep GLT, it's just the Lie algebra object GLT. And for this category, it's just the corresponding Lie algebra. So we've seen that it has acts naturally on all int objects of C. And as a remark, this Lie algebra object can actually be defined for any symmetric tensor category C. So you just take this so-called pi 1 of C, and it's a group scheme in C, and you consider the corresponding Lie algebra object, and then it acts naturally on all objects of your category. But for our purposes, it's enough to consider C to be either rep GLT or representations of a group G.
So can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Can you remind me, inside rep GLT, is there something like the determinant representation or only?
Can you please repeat that?
Are the objects inside rep GLT that look like a determinant representation for every N?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well. And I'm...
The question was about determinant represent analog of determinant in rep GLT.
I have some problems with audio and everything is no. So the question of determinant or sorry.
Yes, is there a determinant representation in rep GLT?
No, there is no such thing.
What?
Yeah. That's the difference. You cannot like you don't have yet any any sure functor is non-zero on your generating object tree. So that's because initially your rep GLT was defined by Dillin as an example of the category which doesn't have a it doesn't have a functor, symmetric tensor functor into vectors, or vector spaces or super vector spaces. It's a category that doesn't allow this Tanakian formalism. It doesn't allow the fiber functor. It's called fiber. Yeah, I forgot the word fiber. I'm sorry. Yeah. And this is sort of the condition for a function to have the fiber functor is to have some sure functors that are zero.
And could the determinant live in some module category for rep GLT?
I'm not sure right now. I'll need to think about this. I'm sorry. I'm just not.
Okay, sorry.
I'll think about it, but right now, I don't know. I'm sorry. So it could maybe continue with this. Is it okay? Yeah. Okay. We could do this in more generality, but for now, so let's stick to these two cases. Now, let me fix some notation. So GOP will be the opposite Lie algebra. U square will denote the tensor product of U of G with U of G opposite. G square is the center of U square. And it's easy to see that this is just the tensor product of two copies of Z. And now let me define the anti-diagonal subalgebra in G plus G opposite, which I denote by K. And it's clearly isomorphic to G. And now any U square module Y in C is the same as U by module because the left action of U of G opposite is the same as right action of U of G. And now there is T taking the restriction of y to k is the same as considering the adjoint representation of y. So that's the defining property of this of our anti-diagonal subalgebra k. Okay, now we say that U by module Y in C is K algebraic if the action of K on Y coincides with the natural action of G. Well, G is isomorphic to K, so this is okay to ask. And morally speaking, we think about objects of C as finite dimensional representations of G. And so this property here, it's asking that the adjoint representation of Y, the action of K on the adjoint of G on the adjoint representation of Y is locally finite. Something like this, but in the categorical setting. Okay, and now K algebraic by modules actually just the same as left U modules in C. So we don't need all the information. So we only need the information about the left action, because if you know the left action and we know the diagonal action, because, well, it's just a natural action on in C, then we can recover the right action as well. And now we say that the U by module Y in NC is called finitely generated if it is a quotient of U tensor X tensor U, where the action here, the left action is just the left multiplication on the left tensor factor, the right action is just the right multiplication on the right tensor factor. And finite generatedness here stands for the fact that X is in C. So it's in some sense a finite dimensional object. And in this case, we say that Y is generated by X. And now a nice example of a bimodule is the following. So you take X in C, and we can define the structure of the bimodule on the tensor product of X with U. And I denote the corresponding bimodule phi X. So that the right action here is just the right multiplication on the right factor. And the left action is on the both factors using co-multiplication, just natural here and left multiplication here. Then it can be easily seen that phi x adjoint is just the tensor product of x with u adjoint. And the adjoint action on the universal enveloping algebra is the natural action. So it's the same as x tensor with s of g. So this is a direct sum of finite dimensional stuff. So it's easy to see that phi x is k algebraic. And it is also finitely generated as it is a quotient of u tensor x tensor u. Okay, now I finally want to define what a Harish-Chandra bimodule is, but I want to do this in a general setting in the category C in the way that it's compatible with the usual definition of Harish-Chandra bimodules. And now there are two natural ways to do this. So let Y in MT be a finitely generated K algebraic bimodule, and we can either ask that the multiplicity of each finite dimensional thing of each X and C in Y adjoint is finite. So this is some sort of admissibility condition. And or we can ask that Z square acts finitely on Y. That is the annihilator inside Z square of Y is an ideal of finite codimension. And it turns out that in the most general setting possible, the condition Y always implies condition two, and condition one always implies condition two. And let me sketch the proof. So Z square commutes with the action of K. Therefore, it acts on this multiplicity space of X inside Y adjoint. And since this is by assumption finite dimensional, the annihilator inside Z square of this multiplicity space is going to be an ideal finite codimension. And now we take X such that it generates Y. And then it is easy to check that the two annihilators must actually coincide. And okay, but why do we need these two ways? It turns out that they are equivalent in the classical setting. So if C is a category of representations of the group G, then condition two implies condition one as well. And this is a corollary of a Costin's theorem that describes the structure of universal enveloping algebra as a module over its center. And but let me pick a more general definition as a definition for Harish-Chandra bimodule. So we say that Y is a Harish-Chandra bimodule if it satisfies condition two, that is the center acts finitely on Y. And I denote by HC the corresponding category. And I say that if Y satisfies condition one, that is this admissibility thing, the multiplicities are finite, then we say that it is a Harish-Chandra bimodule of finite K type. And why do we need two different definitions here? Well, that is because in complex range, they are actually different. And so let theta be some central character of U of GLT, and let U theta be the quotient of U by the kernel of theta. And then it's easy to see that U theta is a Harish-Chandra bimodule because, well, the center acts on the left and on the right via central character here. But it can be shown that it's not a finite K type. And the reason for this is, well, roughly speaking, is again Costin's theorem. It says that the multiplicity of each finite dimensional thing inside U theta is a dimension. So in the classical case, it is a dimension of a zero weight space of this finite dimensional thing. And this dimension, it grows polynomially with n. So, well, in some sense, in the limit case, you'll get something that is not finite dimensional, but it's just the intuition behind this. But there is also a rigorous proof for this. Yeah, and okay, so now, yeah, now we have our two definitions. And because we have this finite action on the center, the condition two, we have a block decomposition on HC. So HC, the category C, is a direct sum of the categories HC tilde of theta one, theta two. And by this, I denote the subcategory on which the center, Z square, which is just the tensor product of two copies of Z, acts with generalized central character. So I stress that it's generalized central character, theta one tensor, theta two. And the question that we want to answer now is for which pairs, theta one, theta two, is this category non-zero? And of course, it is enough to consider the smaller subcategory, HC theta one, theta two without the tilde. It's a subcategory in which the center acts via non-generalized central character, theta one, theta two. And this is because we have, for each non-zero object in here, we'll have filtration with a quotient in here. Okay, and now, let me state a small lemma. So if Y is an object in HC theta one, theta two, then it is a quotient of phi x of theta two. And by this, I denote the quotient of the bimodule phi x that we had before by the kernel of theta two on the right. So as an object, it's just going to be x tensor u theta two. And it's not a difficult lemma, but I don't have time to prove this. So let me state the answer in the classical case. Now, if C is a category of representations of group G, then HC theta one theta two is non-zero if and only if there exist verbal modules M chi one and M chi two, such that the center acts via theta I on M chi I, and such that the difference of these two weights lies in the lattice of integral weights for group G. So that is, it is a weight for some finite dimensional representation of group G. Let me sketch the proof. So any module by the lemma before is a quotient of phi x of theta two. And now if Z acts via theta two on M chi, U theta two embeds into endomorphisms of normal module M chi. And therefore our phi x of theta two, x tensor U theta two embeds into Holmes, linear Holmes between M chi and x tensor M chi. So if you want to look at the left action of the center on this thing, it's enough to look at the action of the center on this thing. And now x tensor M chi has a standard filtration by other Verma modules. m chi plus lambda, where lambda runs over the multiset of weights of x. Therefore, it lies in this integral lattice for g. Yeah, so this is the sketch of the proof. Now, let me state the result in the convex rank. So let C be rep GLT. Then HC theta 1, theta 2 is non-zero if and only if the difference of the exponential generating functions for theta 1 and theta 2 is given by this formula here with exponents. And so you get here, the exponents here differ by 1. And here you have a plus this thing and minus this thing for some R and S and some complex numbers BI, CJ. And let me give you sense of what the answer looks like in not in type A. So if C is rep OT or rep SP to T, then this category is non-zero if and only if the difference of this exponential generating functions is given by such a formula with hyperbolic cosines. And I just want to comment the differences we get here. So recall that we picked, so these formulas really depend on our choice of generators. It's just a way of storing this information, and we really need to fix a choice of generators to write something down. And here, our choice was, so we picked some W invariant polynomials, which were power sum polynomials. But in the case of OT and SP to T, the corresponding W will be not the symmetric group, but the semi-direct product of symmetric group with Z mod 2 Z to the power N. And therefore, we'll need to consider symmetric polynomials in squares of our variables. And we can pick the same power sums, but only the even power sums. Therefore, we'll get hyperbolic cosines instead of exponents. Now, another difference that we have here is that there is only this positive summation without this minus part here. And this is due to the fact that we don't have V dual. So so for OT and SP2T, V is isomorphic to V dual. And yeah. And this is just the formula, and I want to give the sketch of the proof just to give you a sense how it compares to the classical case. So the idea of the proof is as follows. So we know that any bimodule is a quotient of this phi x of theta 2, and any x, reasonable x, is a quotient of this generating objects Rf. Now, we want to understand for which theta 1 the quotient, which I denote phi x theta 1 theta 2. This is just the quotient of the phi x by central kernels of central characters theta 1 and theta 2, both on the left and on the right. We want to understand for which pairs of central characters it's non-zero, and it's enough to take x to be Rs, as I said before. And we do this by induction on the sum R plus S. And we do this in the classical case setting, and then we take the ultra product. And now, I want to give you some computation here. So let me fix a notation. So let eta be a map from the set of weights to the set of central characters. And it just sends a weight to the corresponding central character. Now, I want to do the computation when Rs is equal to 1, 0, just the basic one. Then, so in the classical case, we want to look at phi vn of theta 2. And as before, it embeds into linear homes from m chi to vn tensor m chi, where the corresponding tensor central character to chi is theta 2. And again, so if you want to look at the left action of the left copy of the centron here, we want to look at the action of the left of just the center on this center product. And so again, this has standard filtration. And we see that the only central characters that can appear here are of the form eta of chi plus ei, where e1 through en are weights of vn. Now, So let us compute the central characters on our generators, the chi of n. So they were just a power sums polynomials, and adding ei to chi is just shifting its I coordinate by one. So this is just the case power sum polynomial of chi where the I coordinate is shifted by one. So it's given by this formula. Now, if you take the difference of the two central characters for exponential generating functions for them, then we see so eta of chi of u, well, it is the exponential generating function for just the power sum polynomials for chi. So we actually want to compute this exponential generating function for this difference here. And you see that it's just the difference of two exponents, and the coefficients here differ by one. And now we take the outer product and we get this for some b. This is the difference of two exponents. And if you now compare this to the formula that we had before, see it's very similar, but we only have one sum with plus. And this is because r is equal to one and s is equal to zero. And now, so we computed this only if part. So we proved the only if part. So if this is non-zero, then yeah, it can be non-zero only if the difference of central characters is given by this formula. But what about the if part? So for which complex numbers b, there are actually some non-zero Harshchandra bimodules in the corresponding categories. And the answer for the classical case will be that there is only finite number of such b's, right? So these coefficients here were chi i's, and chi I is just the coordinate of the corresponding weight for our fixed central character. So no more than n of this. But in the complex range, there is happens this outer product phenomenon. And it turns out that you can get any value, any complex value B in C works. And yeah, so this can also be proved. And I'm almost run out of time. And I wanted just to mention that this sort of phenomenon happen also because we had two definitions of Harshchandra bimodules. In a sense, this finite key type definition was more nice also because, so here, if you now want to understand whether our objects have, necessarily have finite lengths, then the answer is no, they won't have finite lengths in our greater category HC, theta one, theta two. But now if you look at the bimodules of finite key type, then they turn out to have finite lengths. And maybe they are in a sense nicer to study, but they are more difficult to classify. And I had also like a few slides about this finite key type bimodules, but I'm afraid I don't have time. I mean, if you're interested, I can comment on this, but the idea is that we don't know how to classify them, but there is a combinatorial way to at least construct some generic examples for them. And maybe they don't classify everything, but they give you probably the sense of how the generic bimodule of finite key type look like. Yeah, so let me finish here. And if you'll have any questions, I'll gladly answer this. Thank you.
Can I ask a slightly informal question? So what can you, I mean, you're going to describe the set of possible central characters, but what can you say, if anything, about categories themselves? So say that if you impose this finite key type condition, then get every object will have finite length, but what else could you say? I mean, is there any question one can ask about the categories themselves?
You can ask a lot of questions, but I am afraid I won't have answers for them. I know very little, I'm afraid. So
for example, do you know anything about irreducible objects?
So that's the problem. Yes. So simple objects. They are more difficult to classify in this case because of the. So the problem is. So if you want to, in some sense, mimic the classical proofs, and just treat this as a regular Hirschandra by modules, but with some twist, but you cannot do this because. Because of this, you won't have finite length condition, and it makes life difficult in a sense. So you didn't. So the classical proofs I know of, they also look at the action of your Hirschandra bimodules on the category O, for example, and this. And you treat them like functors, and they're going to be. You can classify projective objects, and you know your projectives will be all indecomposed as a direct sums, finite direct sums of indecomposable projectives, and then everything is very nice, and you just classify this stuff. And here, it doesn't work like this, unfortunately. And right now, I don't know how to go about this. And some idea I was trying is to so the problem here is you don't have the torus, so you don't have the Cartan subalgebra and this weight structure and this is a mighty tool and you just don't get anything like this here, but you can look at the parabolic category O. So you can actually, so you recall that we had this functor from, so this universal property of Rep GLT that it can be mapped to anything that has objects of dimension T. And now let me pick the category that is just Rep GL T1, dealing the standard product, squared and the product of categories Rep GL TK, where the sum of TIs is equal to T. And this sort of gives you the decomposition of GLT as this.
Or European counterparts.
Block. Is it, so sorry, is somebody saying something?
No.
Okay. You can just have this decomposition of GLT into just into this, blocks, and this will give you some Levy subalgebra. So GLTI is the product of GLTIs will sit inside your GLT as a some Levy subalgebra, and you can do the parabolic versions of all constructions of representation theory. So you can consider parabolic category O, for example, and something like this. And then you can consider actions of Hirschandra bimodules on this. But right now, I didn't get much progress with this, unfortunately. So it wasn't easy for me. So I didn't correct this yet. So I don't know how to classify simple example or projectives.
And is there any chance that the project, like, so you know, I have a slightly weird perspective on this stuff because I've thought a lot in recent years about you know, basically what happened, the category of functors that's generated by tensoring with the natural representation and it's dual. And then like, there's one more interesting thing you need, which is the action of the Casimir. And this is a nice guy to work with. And somehow in this T case, right, you should be basically just getting the Wald-Brauer algebra as the endomorphisms. And then like extra center stuff, right?
As endomorphisms of what, sorry?
I'm just kind of free associating on the sort of stuff that I've done. So I'm maybe even kind of repeating stuff from your talk, but you know, one natural way to look for Harshchandra bimodules is to start with the identity bimodule, where the endomorphisms are the center, and then start tensoring that with copies of the natural representation and its dual.
Yeah.
Right, and that has an action of Wald-Brauer.
Yeah.
And in the finite type case, you can get all the representations by doing that. But, you know, in over GLN for N an integer, like that action of Wald-Brauer isn't faithful. Like it has some polynomial relation. I should say affine Wald-Brauer. You have this action of affine Wald-Brauer. There's a relation between the dot and affine Wald-Brauer in the center.
Okay.
And somehow, like, right, I just wonder if there's some nice answer thinking about this kind of affine Wald-Brauer picture. Where, of course, you also have to incorporate the action of the center. Like those, you can think of that as like bubbles that float around in your Wald-Brauer picture.
I will need to think about this more. I'm sorry, I just...
I understand. Because, I would have guessed that the simples, that it ends up being like... I don't really want to say exactly the simples from Wald-Brauer. That sounds very optimistic. Maybe.
You can produce some continuous families of irreducibles. There are a lot of them, and it's definitely not like a finite number, discrete family of.
So can I ask, like, if I take just tensoring with the standard representation, like the standard representation tensored with U?
Okay, yes.
I look at quotient, are there like a bunch, is there like a continuous family of quotients of that guy?
Do you want to fix some of the central characters here?
Yeah, sorry. I want to fix the central character on one side.
Yeah, then that's a computation that we had here, right? So this is sort of the thing that you'll get is that you'll get the all possible. Oh, sorry. So you'll get all possible things that differ by this. I don't want to say anything wrong right now, but I think you can get this even for V. This is a statement about just central characters without the regard of this thing that you take in the quotient off. So I'm not trying to say that you'll get necessary everything, but I think you will. But
That makes perfect sense. So I think up to whatever transformation, that B is the eigenvalue of the dot in affine Wald-Brauer with one strand.
Hmm.
Right. So there's a version of affine Wald-Brauer where you have these dots, bubbles floating around that correspond to the action of the center, and there's a formula for moving those bubbles across one strand, and it's exactly the eigenvalue of the dot acting on that bubble shows up in the picture. So I think that's exactly what's happening here, that you're getting this affine Wald-Brauer. There's a polynomial generator, right? Like one way to say this is, you have the functor of take a module over your, let's talk about GLN right now, tensor that with some fixed thing, say the standard representation, that has an endomorphism that comes from the Casimir, right? And this B could be interpreted as something about like how the Casimir is acting. And, you know, like in your kind of full picture, it's going to be acting like freely. Mm-hmm. And so this B is like imposing a relation on it, but it's, you know, because it's acting freely, I can get any eigenvalue I want by taking a quotient. Whereas in like the finite type case, it already satisfied some polynomial and I just got the roots of that polynomial.
I see, that's interesting. I would be very grateful if you can give me some reference to at least some of the computations with this.
Sure.
I don't know if that's in any sense connected to what you're saying, but no, you're probably not. No, I mean, you were saying something different. I just wanted to give a quick remark. So, is there something you can study? So, if you construct like some examples of bimodules of finite K type, then you can tensor these bimodules with V and V dual. This will give you the categorical action of SLZ. And in this example I computed what modules for SLZ you can get here, but I don't know if it's in any way what you're saying is connected to, you know, the action of SLZ, because, you know, when you have V and V dual in the section of Casimir, it's like it's the same, it gives you the SLZ action on your underlying category, but then not sure if it's directly connected to what you're saying. But yeah, I cannot really comment on this because I really need to learn stuff before. I didn't think about this in this way, and it sounds very interesting, and I would be happy to read some reference on this and think this through.
I'm just putting in the chat. I can also email it to you later.
Oh, okay. I didn't read the chat at all, and I see that there were some. So the T's wage power is something. I just wanted to mention that I didn't cover this at all, but you can also define the delinked category for the symmetric group Sn, and you'll get rep as T, and this allows you sort of to think about T's wedge powers and stuff like this. But yeah, it's maybe more related to your question than my rep GLT thing. But yeah, so it's maybe on the side of the action of the symmetric group rather than.
The sort of problem I'm thinking about is that suppose you take, polynomials in the joint of GLN, right? And then you look at invariant polynomials, you find polynomials in the traces, right? Trace of x squared all the way to trace of x to the n. If I do the naive sort of T, analytic continuation to T, then I'll have all the traces. And I lose all the trace relations. But I'm wondering if there is any sense in which one can somehow remember about trace relations or determinants or things like that.
I think I don't know. Like, I mostly, maybe there is way which I don't know about yet. I don't want to like give you this answer no right now, because maybe but what you're saying, it seems more about the, you know, invariant of some other symmetric group. So maybe it makes more sense in the context of symmetric group, as I said, but I'm not sure. So I'm more thinking about this as so the intuition behind this is rather you consider this n as a polynomial. I mean, for GLN, consider n as a polynomial, as some coefficient, and everything depends polynomially on n, and then you misplace it by t. But in what you're saying, it's not like it depends polynomially on n, and now I'm confused. But it's more like you consider, you know, the stable behavior of your representations for GLN. When n goes to infinity, it feels more like this rather than to. But I don't really know.
For example, I could look at representations which differ from the determinant by finite amount, right? Things like West products of n minus k
I see what you're saying, but
and this could perhaps be a module category for rep GLT.
Yeah, I see. Maybe you can make sense of this. So still need to think about this more, and right now a bit too stressed to think clearly. Sorry. But thank you. Yeah, sounds interesting. Yeah, I'll need to think about this.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've been working on some situations where you compute indices, sort of Euler characters or certain Chevalier complexes for UN, for GLN. And these indices have a dependence on n, which is very nice. So they look like something plus, I don't know, it looks like they can be reproduced by sort of ignoring the trace relations, but then adding extra things which are sort of coming from determinants and whose contribution cancels I don't know how to say it properly, but it feels like perhaps there is some version of sort of the symmetric polynomials in the adjoint representation inside GL representations of GLT, which wants to keep track of things like determinants too, not just finite powers. But
yeah, no, I don't know.
And it's okay, right? I was just wondering.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for the comment. That's definitely something to think about.
All right. Were there any other questions? All right, then let's thank Alexandra again.